Welcome to the Who Cares podcast, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at Georgia Southern University. Welcome back to Who Cares, casual conversations with Southern scholars. Today, Ryan and I are pleased to bring to you Dr. Beverly Miller. She is an assistant professor of elementary and special education at the College of Education at Georgia Southern University. And Beverly has some unique experiences that she's going to talk to us about today, Ryan. She has done a ton of work in getting minority and underrepresented students into STEM, primarily through a lot of summer camps, if I understand correctly, Beverly. And I'd really love to just hear more about it. So welcome to the show.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great privilege and an honor for me to be able to share and just kind of let folks know how important it is for those alternative educational avenues and things that we provide for kids and how just what an impact they can have. So, I guess let me just share a little bit of my background, because I think that'll help a little bit to understand then, you know, how I got to this place. So, first of all, I'm an immigrant. I was born in Panama, in Central America, but I came to the U.S. when I was 6 years old, so I've had all of my formal education here in the States. As an Afro-Latina woman, it really has kind of helped me to identify with the community, but also to understand some unique challenges and struggles that people have around with those being underrepresented, and especially in STEM education. So I became a science teacher. I have my bachelor's in psychology, and I had my master's in education, and went into science education, and largely because at the time there was such a need for science teachers. We still have a national shortage. I mean, data research actually says that we are like in need of up to 10,000 science and math teachers. So it's not something that's gone away since I became a science teacher. It's unfortunately just exacerbated itself. So became a science teacher, and then almost 15 years later, I am working as an adjunct at the University of New Mexico and was offered an opportunity to work on my PhD. And in doing that, this had happened countless number of times. I was definitely going to focus on STEM, underrepresentation of populations in STEM, whether it's African Americans, whether it is people of Hispanic heritage, whether it's Native Americans because of my work in New Mexico. But one of the things that happened in one of my first classes was someone asked something about the history of African Americans in the U.S. And they looked to me as one of the few people of color, one of the few black people in the room, and it's like, Beverly, what do you think? And at that point, you know, being, almost 40 at that time, I just honestly, at that time, I was able to just say, look, I don't know. Because before, I always felt like I had to give an answer. I had to have a response of some sort and understand what it means to be African American, what it means to be black in the U.S. And at that point, I realized, you know what, how about really doing a work and a study that focuses primarily on those who are of African descent but are not African Americans, and be able to share our experience, if you will, in STEM, and also be able to say, look, we contribute, but our stories are just a little bit different and have a little bit different challenge. So I say all that to say then, my work has evolved into addressing the global needs of those of African descent, Latina heritage, of course, because I'm from Central America, but primarily, what is it about being of African descent that excludes us from STEM education and in STEM careers? Unfortunately, research tells us that, and the World Health Organization, there's so much research and data that says people of African descent receive the poorest education on the continent, poorest levels of education. We have the poorest healthcare outcomes. Economically, we're so deprived and so behind as well. So because of that then, it helped me to really focus my research. How then do I target this particular group of people that globally seem to share, regardless of where we're from, whether we're in the U.S., the data is the same, whether we're in Panama, whether we're in Brazil, it's actually worse in Brazil, but globally, and certainly the continent of Africa, we seem to share these common things. So because of that, then, I was very privileged to be educated in one of the greatest nations on the planet. That has given me a lot of access and a lot of knowledge then on how to do it. So I feel like I've been privileged to become this someone that can really then share out and then present give educational opportunities then, if you will, and through my insights and my personal learning, my personal journey. So one of the things that I've been privileged to do is at the end of my my dissertation work, I did a postdoc in South Africa for 2 years and actually lived on the continent and lived in Johannesburg, South Africa, and worked at the University of Johannesburg. And this really gave me a great insider opportunity and opportunity to kind of see what it's like to be of African descent from the continent. From the continent of Africa, where all of civilization started, and certainly where of African descent I'm from, to find how difficult it was really hard. To find that there were issues of race, and to find that I'm trying to think of which one to share. One of the things that was difficult was finding out different levels of privilege. So on the one hand, my education and my U.S. education was always a privileged position I can count on. So when I spoke at the University of Johannesburg and they heard my voice in the hallway, then people scrambled to open doors or they scrambled to give me a seat. But if I didn't speak, then I was just another woman of African descent walking down the hallway and was marginalized and was treated in a way that was dishonoring, if you will, and disrespectful at times. Disrespectful in the case that if I was, there's a line that started and someone saw me and they were white or even colored, as it's denoted in South Africa as well, then they felt that they can jump in front of me. So I spent a lot of time being 5'2", saying, I was here first. You may not jump in front of me. And of course, once they heard me speak, because of my privileged position from having a very strong U.S. accent, then the apology started and the fumbling. So because I'm a researcher, I began to play with this. I was like, whoa, okay. This is how it goes, huh? Okay, let's see how this works out. So I did. I started to put it to the test. I would sit in place and try not to speak and then see how I was treated. And then I would just say one thing and then see the changes in the facial expressions and things like that. So then because of, and I kind of jumped in the middle, my work in South Africa was built on the work I'd already done here in the States. I'd already been a science teacher for 17 years, middle school science teacher, absolutely loved middle school, even though I did teach K through 8th grade in Chicago, and then later on in New Mexico. Loved the population, absolutely loved teaching students. And what I loved was, regardless of gender, and even race in New Mexico was primarily convincing Hispanic and Native American students that you can do this. There was no group of people that was so gifted that they were the ones that were to be in science and to be in math. You can do this. So I loved having to see those lights go on, if you will, for all students. So because of that, then my work in South Africa just was more of the same. Doing the postdoc on the campus, though, but then seeing the needs of children in Soweto and all around me in Johannesburg. So of course I couldn't just do that, not address that. So I started a Saturday science club, and ended up working with both students of African descent in South Africa, but also the colored population in South Africa, which is, of course, mixed race people. And they're often, their educational outcomes is pretty bad as well, because of the hegemonic structure there. So coming back to the US then, interestingly enough, I always wanted to do something in my native home country of Panama, and I went all the time, but never considered because of the fact that my Spanish was not that strong, and it's not the greatest now, but it's good. So I just really didn't know how was I going to be able to teach this subject that I loved in Spanish so that the students could really embrace it. But in 2017, that's exactly what happened. I had the opportunity to start a STEM camp. And at first I told the group there, okay, I only have 30 students. Okay, let me start with a small group and fumble through. Well, 45 showed up. And anybody that knows me can tell you, there's no way I'm turning away any child. Anyone that wants to learn, we can cram them in. So we ended up with 45 students, and it was three other people that went with me on what I call this incredible dream that was started in 2017, working within the country of Panama and doing a STEM and literacy camp, because for the Panamanian school system, English is now part of the structure, if you will. So being able to then address that through this week-long science STEM camp from Monday to Friday. What was it? We worked from 9 to about 3 with the kids.
Okay. So Beverly, let me stop you there. So we're talking about this summer camp, and I think I want to back up and just ask you, in general, sort of, why do we do summer camps? What is the benefit to students of summer camps? Is there any benefit to them in terms of STEM or just in general education?
Okay, so I think there's a huge benefit that I think a lot of us would take for granted, not only those of us in academia, but also just in the community at large. So one thing to me is we create a safe place for students, a safe space for learning where there isn't that smart kid in the class, you know, and then, you know, we wait for him to answer all the questions while we, the other students, sit back and don't know. We kind of level that playing field, especially when we bring students from across different school systems, across different, you know, different schools, but also when we even merge grade levels, which is something that, you know, we do, of course, in the camps that I do, because we just end up with so many kids, so you'll have maybe 6th and 7th and 8th grade working together, or two grade levels working together. So then it kind of takes that sting out of, you know, I'm usually the smart kid, so now there is no the smart kid. So we kind of disarm and dismantle that. The second thing is we bring materials and supplies and equipment, and this is the one thing I found working in Chicago and then New Mexico. There's so many schools where students don't get hands-on science. They don't get to play with Legos. And that is, you know, we take it for granted. We would like to believe as an American society that every child gets educational materials for Christmas in addition to their video games or whatever, or their whatever, PSP. I don't know these games anymore, so I may just date myself. But they don't. So I have worked with so many students in Albuquerque, New Mexico, certainly in Panama, where they have never seen Legos, where I'm having to show them, this is how you connect these pieces. And then you throw in connects, and that's a whole other mental challenge, and also certainly supporting those engineering process skills that NGSS has just now recently added. So those are the two big ones. Mm-hmm. The third, of course, well, I have two more. So the third one to me is then we get to make it fun and engaging for students. I'm not in the classroom. I'm not your classroom teacher. I don't have to worry about standards in the same way. I'm not time restraint in, I don't have the time restraint the same way. I can really spend an hour and a half with you, and this happened at the Boys and Girls Club for real, with you building a well out of Kinex, and you didn't get it, and the next day, we just get back to it. Because there is no, oh my gosh, I gotta get to literacy, and oh no, we are done with our science time. In alternative educational programs, we have that time that's on in our side. And researchers say, certainly got Diffley, you've got Hirsch, and many researchers who are supporting a lot of these ideas. So these are not my thoughts, of course, or just my findings from the programs that I've done. The last one, though, which is one I've kind of added to my work in Panama significantly, because I piloted it or tested it out, if you will, in Chicago and then in New Mexico, was the whole idea of adding an experience or learning component. And again, you got a lot of research support that really puts value on the connection of the curriculum to an experiential learning. For example, it's one thing, and we're getting ready to do this now in Georgia, so here's a great example. It's one thing for me to talk about paleontology all week and geology and talk about dinosaurs. It's another thing for me to now go to the Georgia Southern Museum and see that dinosaur and see these artifacts. And then I have a worksheet, which is what I'm going to do for real too, for the students to work through in these tasks, and they see the mastodon, and they see the comparison of that to the mammoth, because we've been talking about it all week long in class, and then now I tie the curriculum and the content together with this museum that's going to give and support the learning in this rich and hands-on way, if you will.
Awesome. So. Well, so it sounds like, just to, if I can sum up here, the benefits of these programs is it really allows freedom both from the educator point of view to do some things that may not be feasible in the classroom, but also some freedom for the student to engage at a level that they're comfortable with.
Yes. And I love, yeah, we know in terms of educators, yes, there's that level of freedom. So I can create, I can like expand on a concept. This summer, the students will make fossils, and I can take that time and do that because I'm not driven by a director or a principal or a time constraint. Look at it from that student perspective, then we are really giving them what they don't get a chance to have during that school year and activity. You know, what about that student who, you know, they love earth science, but we've got to move on to the next chapter.
Yeah.
And next chapter is not earth science.
Not earth science. And we lose them.
That's
so it. So I know there's a, like, students and parents, they seem to want summer programming, but sometimes it can get so expensive. Are there options that parents should be looking at that maybe aren't offered through a college or a university? Or does online learning, like in this environment, work as well? Do we know?
Oh my goodness, that is such a... I started by thinking about myself as a parent. And one of the places I used to look for my own children, which now, I mean, my goodness, I didn't put two and two together. I used to start with the museums. What museum programs are available? What are the costs on those? And when our children were younger, we were in Chicago. So some of those were outrageous. But I would try and find at least one or two for each of them and then plug them in. And then those would be the ones that would cost, if you will. But then there are other programs where you can, and I don't know about the equivalent to what we found there would have been the wildlife center here on campus, where you may find like an hour program. And, you know, yeah, it might be $10 or whatever the cost is. But even those have a big impact because they expose the children to information and a depth that they don't get. They get to see these monocots and know why we call them monocotyledons, as opposed to, you know, a monocot and dicot, and, you know, here's a worksheet, and here's how it's different. They get to see them. And we know that that's important for learning, you know, the seeing and the doing. Now, in terms of online, this has been a trailblazing time because of COVID. So I would have answered differently had I not just or in the process of completing an online virtual program. So I can now say that, yes, those also are effective because we as educators, if you will, are learning how to do it and how to put in activities, if you will. So, for example, for the virtual camp that I'm just wrapping up or in the process of wrapping up, we had the students make a couple of things. One was an eagle's nest, if you will, and then another one was the fossil. And as educators behind the scenes, we were like, oh my gosh, this is going to be too much for the students. Are we asking too much of parents? But what we found was almost every child, so I would guess around somewhere up as high as 90% of the students came with the things, if you will, that we asked them to build. Now, in this case, we did send out materials, but surprisingly, some of the kids didn't. They didn't use the materials we sent out. They found their own. They put things together, but they accomplished the task, and even through their own creativity. So, for example, we asked them to build a fossil, and we talked about fossils, and one of the students chose to build a dinosaur instead, a replica of a dinosaur, and then he explained how these remains, if you will, would then have become fossilized. So we gave credit, first of all, because we're not in the classroom, so our rubric isn't as strict as, you didn't follow the instructions, oh my gosh. No, that student was able to share their depth of learning. And yes, they took it off on a tangent, but we need to allow that, because we don't know if by allowing that, we have now hooked that child into paleontology, and they might be the future paleontologist or geologist or whatever, as opposed to being so narrow with it. So basically, yes, I would definitely say look in the online programs as well, because we've got to give students every opportunity. And sometimes it's just not going to, we're now post-COVID. Everything's going to look different.
Yes, absolutely. You are correct.
So Beverly, can you tell me about the research part of the work that you do? These programs sound amazing, but there's research that underlies them. And I'm curious to hear you talk about how your scholarship either informs or transforms these the programs that you do.
Okay, so one is I definitely look at a lot of authors, and I just shared a couple that really, there's a lot of evidence for alternative education, period. So certainly you have studies done with places like the Boys and Girls Club and with the YMCA that say these programs help to connect students to mentors. And again, that's good too, because we often think of a mentor as being someone that's, you know, in the field of engineering, so they've got to be an engineer. No, the research has also just proven sometimes students just need that human connection and support academically. So certainly student to mentor, and then student to the curriculum, and having again, programs like the Boys and Girls Club and other programs where we take the curriculum for sixth grade, if you will, and then we support it and then enhance it. The other one that's really big for me, and especially in the work that I do both here now at Georgia Southern and then certainly in Panama, is this experiential learning, and I've already mentioned that. And research is also suggesting that when we tie the curriculum to these field experiences, students then retain the material a whole lot more than when we just give it to them in the classroom. Do give them a worksheet. And those, of course, we killed them to death with worksheets and with videos now even. But the experiential learning work is really saying, when we tie it together, the retention of the material is much stronger, if you will. The last thing that I didn't mention before that we do with our programs, and I know, you know, you don't have to worry about it online, but for us face-to-face, we've got to feed our students. So one of the third component is providing what I call a nutritional meal or nutritional access. Because even this summer, with the kids coming that we're planning for in a month, I can't believe it's a month now, we're providing a small breakfast, if you will. Because again, there's the preponderance of research that tells us and reminds us, hungry children don't learn. So it's always kind of foolish of us as educators to wonder, why is Johnny falling asleep in the corner? Oh my gosh, why won't they pay attention? They can't if they have not had a meal since the night before and we don't know what that meal might have looked like. A lot of our students, and I found this in New Mexico, cold cereal and in Chicago, Fruit Loops was dinner. So one of the things that's really important for this program this summer, especially, and then I definitely do it in Panama because we don't have a choice. Our students in Panama, we provide a solid breakfast as well as lunch, which is in Latin America, lunch is really your dinner. So it's your heavy meal of your rice and your meat and your vegetables. But here, this summer, one of the things to meet this nutritional component is we are having them have a lunch on the Georgia Southern campus. Where they choose the food is what I'm hoping right now. COVID has a little couple of restrictions. But, and one reason is so that certainly students feel more comfortable on campus as we're wanting to welcome them into this university space. But two, it's about the food. It's about the fact that when they get to choose, we're also there to guide. So I'm going to be watching, and yeah, I'm going to say, you're going to have that pizza and all that dessert? No vegetable on that plate, huh? Wow, how is that going to work out? And then we're tying that into some of their activities. So we're not going to be preachy about health and things, but we're just going to be kind of like pointing and directing and just getting it on their radar. And I know this works because in Panama, for the past few years, prior to COVID, of course, I would always tell the students, oh no, before we, antes de comer, vamos a lavar las manos. Let's go and wash our hands. And literally, we were on a field trip, and one of the younger, like kindergarten, first graders, are like, pero maestra, ¿dónde vamos a lavar las manos? And she's like, but where are we going to wash our hands? So even though it was something that I would, like, before we go to eat, we're going to wash our hands, They got it. And then when we're on this field trip where we can't, I'm the one that's having to say, oh my gosh, you're right. We can't wash our hands now. So let's, I can't remember what I did. I made up something. And then So I say that to say, this nutritional component then, we don't have to preach it. I'm not giving out a meal plan or anything. We're just gonna casually, while they're on campus doing this food time, just going to make a couple of suggestions and open their eyes, if you will. And that's it.
Well, no, that's so important because we know as adults, I mean, food is power for your brain. And the right food is the right power. And too much sugar in the morning, you know, you end up crashing. I'm guilty of this myself when I go for the donut rather than, you know, something more healthy. Mm-hmm. And I also really think this whole camp-like experience does give some really informal ways to have fun for students. And I think a lot of teachers are trying to do this in the classroom as well, but they're so constricted by standards and state testing and mandates and all the other components that are coming in, whereas students who are going to camp are typically voluntarily attending a camp. Well, their parents might make them go, but it's something that they want to do. So Ryan, I believe you have the ultimate question now to ask Beverly.
Yeah, this is what I do here. So the question is, who cares? Why should people care about the work that you're doing?
Oh my goodness. Wow, thank you for that. I was not prepared for the question. I don't know why, I don't remember it. If we talked about it. But why care? Because we're talking about our future. And if we don't stop and really, first of all, listen to what's happening in this society and how we're addressing education, if we don't pay attention, we know that we're in a pandemic, and we know, I was just reading this morning in the New York Times, that parents are saying, open the schools already, we can't take it anymore. We know that. But because of that, and because of the climate and the concerns health-wise, we've got to redress these issues, and we're going to have to do it through some transformative measures. We can't just go back to business as usual, and we're going to have to come up with some new strategies, new way of doing things, and new investments, because otherwise we're going to lose these kids. We can't expect that with just going back to full-time learning in August, we're going to be back to normal and the students will be back to normal academically. They're not. They're behind. So these alternative programs come to support and to provide not only enrichment, but also some remediation, you know, and natural remediation, because now I've gotten you hooked on paleontology. You all of a sudden want to do more reading, and I don't make you read. So this is where it's also important. Yeah, I can't think of, I mean, to me, at the bottom line is, we care because these are our children. And these are going to be the future of our country. You know, whether I'm here in the States or whether I'm talking about the future in Panama, these are the people who we're hoping will take over and replace us. I tell my students all the time, I need you to replace me. I don't plan on being here and working indefinitely. So I need to train up those science teachers who will then become researchers and then go into working full-time at the university, if you will, so that we build in our replacement. And if we don't see that we have to invest here, then we really, you know, are going to be in dire shape. So because of that, then the final component, I guess I didn't mention, was that's why those of us who are in this, it's also a mentoring of our students for us. We, you know, when we reach out to people and say, hey, can you speak to students and can you just share your life experiencing? That's all we need. That's being a mentor. We don't need a, you know, this formal contract from you, but we need you to care in even this small way of saying, let me tell you how I made it. And in that way, then we put that hand out for the next generation and we lift them up. You know, I think by now we know, you know, most of us didn't have, you know, these, I'm pulling myself up on my bootstraps because there's some of us like myself, we didn't have boots. Okay. Our families, you know, I am the first, female in my family to have gotten a college education. So, I mean, I could have been, you know, I mean, that was just huge. So that's who I think about. Are those students that we, and those households where they're not asking us for, you know, my family didn't ask for oh my gosh, you know, give us a handout. No. We just need an opportunity. I needed access to education. And I don't know if I mentioned this before too, in terms of the why care. I care because someone did it for me. When I came to this country at 6 years old, my English was very poor. My broken English and Spanish was, my Spanish of course was stronger. English was very bad. And I'm so grateful, I always tell people, I'm so grateful to my New York City public school teachers who didn't look at my phenotype and where I came from and didn't think, oh my gosh, you can barely speak English, what's with this immigrant? They just said, she's got to get the job done. So you all, to my family, please speak to her in English. And then, you know what they did? They signed me up for summer school, which is an alternative program, alternative learning. So even though I went to school during the school year with everyone else, in the summers is what I needed. First of all, I got to hear people speak English and I got to hear the language. Second of all, I got to be exposed to literature and books because again, the culture that I came from, I didn't know Dr. Seuss till I got here. So that's why like really now I'm just like, are you kidding me? Dr. Seuss is great. Because my first exposure was here and sitting in those classes and then being on the floor and those one-on-one with teachers. So I care because someone cared enough about me to provide that for me. And I'm just hoping that I can just be able to do the same thing for someone else's child.
And if I may, I'd like to tell you why I care. And there's a number of reasons. I love that this is your programs here are backed by science, that we know the best way to have young people learn and grow and develop and learn to love. The topic is about science, right? And so it's an introduction to science. And then number three, it's an introduction to science for people who don't normally get that full introduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And developing that love of science is key to almost everything that we do, regardless of the discipline, regardless of the topic. Just learning to love science sets you up to be a lifelong learner, and we need that desperately.
I would agree.
Thank you.
I mean, it's, I think that it takes a very special passion to give up your time to go spend informal learning hours with children who are excited to be there and it's not got the constraints of a formal education. And you do see that they do get in. They can dig into something that
mm-hmm.
they're interested in and they're passionate about. And it just makes you feel good to see it. And,
yes.
You know, and again, science is everywhere. It's in everything
right.
we do. And it's just so important that our students have the access to exposure.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Beverly, thank you so much for joining us for this podcast. We hope to have you back maybe after your summer camps and you can tell us how it went.
Thank you.
And we look forward to speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
I love the work, Beverly. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Wonderful being here.
This has been Who Cares? Casual Conversations with Southern Scholars, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at George Southern University. The opinions expressed here are those of the researchers and the host and not of Georgia Southern University or the University System of Georgia. We would like to give a shout out to Purple Planet for our bumper music. Join us next time for Who Cares? Casual Conversations with Southern Scholars.